Welcome. We'll start the proceedings. You are the ITNJ. We're just functionaries that are what you might call the operating part of the ITNJ. And I'll just mention who we are on the bench and what our role is. At the end is Tom Brown, who's a commissioner, renowned scientist, whose input into the factual material that we've been working on is invaluable. Next to me is Bishop Rea, Bishop of Jerusalem, who is a renowned and well-known human rights advocate, who, apart from being a cleric, is a combination of international diplomat, and he believes in truth and reconciliation, and that's his essential function. To my right is Dr. Chris Cleverly, who has a number of claims to fame, apart from his honour degree of Doctor of Laws. I understand that his national portrait is hanging in the National Gallery in London. So all I've managed to do is get my photograph on some office walls. So towards the end is Dr. Nancy Ash, the Reverend Dr. Nancy Ash. She's a renowned someone who understands the human spirit and has been a driving force of the ITNJ right from the beginning. My name's John Walsh Branner. I started off as the Chief Justice, so welcome. What you'll be hearing today at this gathering is testimony from people that are witnesses to the truth. And they come to present the testimony to assist us in making a change. What I called some time ago is the quiet revolution. So before we proceed with taking testimony from people who want to come forward, I'd like to ask my associate, Justice Cleverly, who wants to make some observations that will help clarify what we're doing.
Yes, obviously, I'm very grateful for the comments there from the Chief Justice, my learned friend. Obviously, you're going to hear some testimony and you're going to hear some depositions today. So we're very grateful for the opportunity to have the witnesses here and here to actually do that today. To help you understand exactly what's going on, to some extent, we should provide a little bit of a map. Where my comments are different from my learned friend, the Chief Justice, please accept his over mine. The main points I think that we need to consider are that we will obviously be taking testimony. We'll observe that many of the comments of those people coming forward are that man itself is the engineer of our extinction, and that we're coming up towards an extinction event. You'll take a view on that, and you'll be able to see that both the audience that's here today and also audiences elsewhere. They have come forward, as many of you in the audience are aware, in an attempt to alert the planet and alert each of us of this potential threat to both the sea, the sky, and the soil. We, the International Tribunal of Natural Justice, have taken these testimonies and depositions to interrogate and weigh these accusations in the knowledge that the accumulation of truth, the aggregation of it as one truth sits upon another, is the very way in which we begin to bind together and weave together a shield that we're built to defend all of us. One person's truth can easily be pushed away, but as we tell the stories and these depositions and written statements are taken, it's the collection of them that itself gives us defense. It has been said before by me, and probably be said again, justice just is. So when we talk about natural justice, we're actually talking about something that are common words. You all know what natural means, and you know what justice is. Justice is what you feel in yourself as your sovereign soul is right. And you should look inside yourself when you hear what's said, and that'll help you make a judgment, a personal judgment, collective judgment as to what you believe is true. The word natural, you know, I don't need to go into that. As I said, you know, it's all around you, right? And whether you call it Mother Earth or you call it Gaia or whatever you want to call it, it is what you are in and you are a part of, and is what is inside of you, and you are an extension of. Natural justice doesn't just apply, as the word clearly says, just to humans, and often we confuse ourselves a little bit with that. It applies to all sentience, and sentience means that which knows that it exists. And it also applies beyond that, because as we become more and more knowledgeable with everything, we start to see that perhaps we're very, very connected with everything about us, and that we're in some sort of a dynamic homeostasis in which everything returns back to what is naturally right. The crimes that you'll hear alleged today are those, as I've said, not just against humanity, but also against sentience. And I want you also to observe and take on board a new word, if you're not familiar with it, which is ecocide. An ecocide, like genocide, which we're very familiar with over the last century, unfortunately, is actually an acknowledgement that there is sometimes a connectedness and a conspiracy and a joint action against the very nature of everything. And that itself may be the greatest crime of all. In listening to the evidence, both the bench and the audience may be assisted in considering the five, I've termed them five indicators, they're just nominal, they're just my choices, but they're ones that I hope we will consider and help you when you're looking at this evidence to sort out the value of it. The five indicators of a conscious conspiracy in matters where ecocide, often the agencies of science, medicine, collude with big corporations in an unholy alliance of the fear of discovery, of incompetent monitoring, regulation, and appraisal, with the eternal and external profit and marketing, profit and market advantages. So what I mean by that is this, is that big corporations colluding knowledge with knowledge or without knowledge, but certainly in joint cohesion, work together to create a profitable market opportunity in which there is then no incentive for governments to change their positions or legislatures to change their positions and make it, essentially a better world for us all, but certainly one that works in operational natural justice. So those five things are these. Firstly, where scientific data has been negligently, recklessly, willfully, perhaps fraudulently manipulated or omitted altogether. Secondly, where any attempt by the independent scientific community or lawyers or men and women of the living soil to question is prevented by state, nation, or international law. Thirdly, where following such prohibitive legislation, all criticism is censored, freedom of speech and action is removed. Fourthly, an inability of state, national, or international organs to admit that they make mistakes, that they are human, and that they are not God. That inability to admit this is sometimes, some ways, worse than the original omission or action. Fifthly, that this may be part of a continued conspiracy running through the ages to desensitize humanity from our sole sovereignty, from our natural justice, as we accept one assault, one upon the other, one infraction against our humanity after another, and in a seemingly perpetual and ignominious enslavement and torture. Without further ado, I return that back to the baton, back to the Chief Justice, and ask him to continue.
Good, thank you, Justice Cleverly. The way we will operate is witnesses will come forward and give their testimony and will be asked questions by any member of the tribunal, either myself, Justice Cleverly, or the other three commissioners. here. So it's not quite a talk fest. What it is an inquiry, and people want to come forward and be listened to and have their views taken into account, and that's what we'll be doing.
Okay, the first this first session here we're doing is on what's apparent ecocide in New Zealand using a poison known as 1080, a sodium fluoroacetate. We have a couple witnesses from New Zealand here, but first we're going to play a short video by Clyde Graff. Clyde Graff and his brother Steve were introduced to the outdoors by their father, Egon. In 1996, Egon's youngest son, Steve, made a trip to Canada with his video camera, captured some amazing wildlife footage. Upon his return, he teamed up with his brother Clyde, and together they began to make the Graff Boys videos. Since then, the Graff Boys have produced 6 DVD titles and 2 documentaries. Their documentary, Poisoning Paradise, has won 4 international awards. The movie Poisoning Paradise is about the aerial dispersal of 1080 throughout New Zealand. Government agencies spread the deadly pesticide all over New Zealand's forests and streams to kill deer, possums, pigs, and rats, but many native species are also killed. So we're going to see a short 10-minute clip of their work to give an introduction, since this is very little known around the world, so this is an opportunity for greater awareness of this ecocide there. Can we roll that, please?
This is our first possum for the day, and I just came across this. It's a doe, female, and when I came over, it was still breathing. It's 20 to 10 in the morning. This is just an issue that does happen with regard to these poisons. The mum dies, and then the little joey's left in the pouch. And as you can see, the joey's still alive. This is another possum that's 12:15. This one's got rigor mortis, whereas the one this morning, earlier around 10 o'clock or 9:45, was still warm and just died. He's almost quite cute, this little fella. Look at him, look pretty, isn't he? Come on, little fella, look at you. It's not really ideal, is it, to kill them like this. I think I'm going to call you Nick Smith. How about that? It's got a ring to it.
Come on. All of the female possums found the day after the drop had live joeys in their pouches. Vets suggest that there will be poison in the mother's milk, but it may be diluted, and a lethal dose of poison may not be consumed by the time the mother dies. 1080 poison bait is aerially spread across large areas of New Zealand's forests and waterways to kill possums and rats. However, the toxic baits also kill thousands of pigs and deer annually, and poisoned animals can suffer for many hours before they die. Many species of native birds, bats, and insects also consume the poisonous food. The poisoned insects and animals can then become toxic meals for unsuspecting native wildlife. And official information shows that kiwi and kea are dying in high numbers in poisoned forests. 1080 poison baits are dropped directly into all waterways at the same rate as the land areas around them in most aerial operations. Aquatic life, such as freshwater crayfish, quickly consume the bait and pass the deadly toxin onto other unsuspecting birds, animals, and fish that eat them. The manufacturer's warning label states, take measures to minimize the chance of baits accidentally entering any body of water and harmful to aquatic organisms. However, no attempt is made to avoid waterways. The official toxin distribution charts show that almost all of the forest streams are poisoned at the same rate as the land areas around them. Around 2 million kilograms of 1080 poison bait is spread by helicopters across New Zealand's forests and waterways every year. Enough poison to kill over 60 million people every year. The factory that imports 1080 poison and manufactures the baits is a state-owned enterprise. The two acting shareholders are the Minister of Finance and the Minister of Primary Industries. Its warning label states that a lethal dose of bait for an adult human could be as little as 30 grams. That's equivalent to just 2.5 of these 12-gram baits. Animals like deer and pigs can consume many more baits than is required to kill them, making their dead bodies massive toxic baits for any bird, animal, or person that eats them. The latency period, which is how long it takes the victim to feel the effects of the poison, can be as long as 29 hours, meaning a live animal could be harvested for food while containing a fatal dose of poison.
The symptoms of 1080 poisoning include vomiting, stomach pains, muscular twitching, blurred vision, mental confusion, followed by coma and convulsions. 1080 poison baits are spread across most of New Zealand's state forest parks. Apart from the targeted animals, the poison also kills thousands of wild pigs. The pigs are either killed by eating the baits directly or by scavenging the poisoned animals that litter the forest floors. Poisoned animal carcasses are left to decompose where they fall, be that on land or in water, despite the manufacturer's warning label stating that they are ecotoxic and that the exposed bodies of all poisoned animals should be collected and buried at a landfill approved for hazardous wastes. This scavenging poses a secondary poisoning risk to native wildlife or to hunters that may catch a pig that's travelled outside of a poisoned area weeks after an aerial operation. Research presented at the Environmental Risk Management Authority review of 1080 poison use undertaken in 2007 stated that it identified three main scenarios that may give rise to meat containing 1080 residues. Farm animals may accidentally get access to 1080. Feral animals taken by hunters may have been poisoned or sublethally poisoned. In other research, it is stated that numerous cases of suspect accidental poisoning of livestock with 1080 occur in New Zealand every year. Extensive independent information about 1080 poison use in New Zealand can be found on the 1080science.co.nz website, and an extensive presentation of film footage of aerial poison operations and documentation can be found on tv-wild.com.
We'd like to call up Dr. Sue Gray, who's here from New Zealand, to speak on this issue. Hailing from New Zealand, Dr. Sue Gray is a self-employed strategist, lawyer, activist, mother, adventurer, and has tertiary qualifications in law, biochemistry, microbiology, and environmental management. Thank you, Sue, for being here.
If I could just introduce my expertise to see if I can be qualified by you as an expert witness.
Yes.
Very good.
I have over 30 years' experience in environmental health policy and enforcement. I have a LLB honours degree, a Bachelor of Science degree in biochemistry and microbiology. I was a Royal Society of Health diploma in public health inspection, which is the qualification used by our health protection officers in New Zealand to assess whether or not to issue permits for 1080 poisoning. I have worked for the Department of Health and I've worked for the Department of Conservation in New Zealand as a conservancy solicitor for over 2 years until I was dismissed for disloyalty to the Crown when I raised an issue about the apparent bias of a Supreme Court justice. I have considerable experience in issues relating to 1080 poison in New Zealand and am the lawyer that most people who have issues with 1080 come to see if they have a problem in New Zealand. I've actively been involved since 2013 with the Nidia Bay poison drop. In 2017, I acted for the Brook Valley community near my home in Nelson. That community has been through the court system to the Supreme Court. I acted for the what we call the not botulism family in Pitararu, who were suspected to have suffered from 1080 poison, and that was the first diagnosis. But during the overnight course of their first night in hospital in a coma, the diagnosis was changed somehow to botulism, and it was publicly reported to the media for the next 4 to 6 weeks as suspected botulism, even though none of the symptoms or tests were consistent with botulism. I also acted for the Auckland community when the Department of Conservation and the Auckland City Council decided that they wished to aerially 1080 poison the Hinua Ranges, which is the main water catchment area for New Zealand's biggest city, Auckland, and they did it to protect or try and protect a native bird. So we went to the Environment Court to say that the safety of public water should take precedence over protection of native birds, as that was the catchment for that water. I speak on a large amount of public meetings and to community groups to educate on 1080 poison and public policy and law relating to 1080 poison. and to the media. I'm a frequent commentator, although our media in New Zealand don't like reporting 1080 poison issues. I'm also the author of a fisheries law textbook for the fisheries volume of the Laws of New Zealand, which is part of a collection of LexisNexis Laws of New Zealand. I'm hoping that that qualifies me as an expert.
Yes. On behalf of the bench sitting here, we accept you as an expert witness. And just for the explanation that I'll give to the people who are listening, the difference between an expert witness and an ordinary witness is an ordinary witness can give evidence as to what he or she saw, or he or she heard, or what he or she observed, whereas an expert witness can give an opinion as to not only what happened, but why it happened and how it happened. So there's a differentiation between the two. It's not one that we made up, it's one that's been made up over the last 200 years in various courts and tribunals. Because sometimes people come to the court and think their opinion should be taken into account, like television commentators do, and tribunals and other bodies hearing evidence do split it into two parts. So this allows Dr. Gray not only to say, well, I saw the 1080 poison being dropped into the water, but she can, as an expert, say what this actually means and give an opinion.
Thank you. I've prepared a PowerPoint presentation, but the computer's crashed, but I think I can probably cover most of it. And if the computer turns on again partway through, I'll pick it up.
I think Dr. Gray would prefer to hear from you in any event.
I'm here today to make formal testimony about what, in my opinion, is ecocide in New Zealand. And it's ecocide to the world. It's done by the New Zealand government and or condoned by the New Zealand government in their self-created war on nature. It's done through the aerial spreading of sodium fluoroacetate poison, also known as 1080 poison, which is spread by helicopter over much of New Zealand's land in the form of cereal baits. The purpose is to try and attract the designated predators, stoats and rodents, to eat these 1080 poison baits. But unfortunately, as our government well knows, 1080 poison baits are not specific to possums and rodents. They kill numerous other species. Indeed, they kill every species that eats them. They kill both by primary kill, if the animal eats it directly, and they kill by secondary kill if an animal eats another carcass of an animal that's been poisoned by 1080. There are considerable warnings on the labels for 1080, which are designed to protect the community. The warning starts: deadly poison, keep away from children, harmful to aquatic organisms, avoid putting into water supplies and water courses, collect dead carcasses, and long details of mandatory warnings that are part of the compulsory approval for the label. It's compulsory that those labels be complied with. Unfortunately, there's no compliance, and indeed it's impossible for compliance because the main predator that the government is concerned about now are stoats, and stoats don't eat 1080 poison baits. They don't eat cereal baits because stoats are carnivores. So the only way the stoats can be killed are if the poison carcasses, which are supposed to be removed, are left lying around over the forest floor, but also very frequently in the waterbeds, because that is where the poisoned animals typically go to die. And the stoats eat dying or dead carcasses and themselves killed by secondary poisoning. So the very philosophy that the, or the very purpose of killing stoats cannot be achieved if the label is complied with. It's impossible. The problem we have with this aerial poisoning is that it is creating the very rat plague and stoke problem that the government complains of. If you change the ecosystem, you select for the fastest adapter.
The fastest adapters are not our rare native birds, which are poisoned in the poison drops, but the rats. And the rats can breed very, very quickly compared to the native birds. So what the research shows, and the government's own research shows, is that although after a poison bait, the forest is silent and the rat numbers are well down, after 3 to 6 months, the rat numbers will be higher than they ever were before the poison drop, because they now have a free space without competition to spread out and take over the ecosystem. And so the cycle continues, because the monitoring shows that there's now a rat plague, and so the government feels they need to have another 1080 poison drop. It is, as I said, a war on nature that is unwinnable, and indeed the government is creating the very cycle that it uses to justify its action. What's happened, we started with some quite strict rules on when 1080 poison could be used. 10 or more years ago, was only to be used in the most remote locations. There were buffer zones around watercourses. There was considerable public processes where communities could be consulted about when and where poison would be used and what alternatives were available. But over the last couple of years, the government has lost sense of the very conditions that were imposed to control the use of poisons, and it's become almost an obsession that aerial poisoning is the way forward in their eyes, and they've taken steps to exclude public consulting. So, for example, in my Brook community, we suffered from the first aerial poison drop where there was no public there was public consultation. The public consultation resulted in a consent with 49 conditions to try and protect the environment. But then our Minister for the Environment changed the law to exempt all aerial poisoning from all of our usual resource management processes, all of the public consultation processes, all of the processes for imposing conditions to manage the effects of 1080 poison, and all of the ability to cost recover for enforcing all of the conditions. And instead, it was basically free slather. So this aerial poisoning of the Brook Sanctuary near my home, over a 711 hectare sanctuary, went from having 49 conditions of consent to no conditions of consent. My community, I led a case to the High Court of New Zealand challenging the legality of those regulations on the grounds that they were contrary to the purpose of the underlying statute, which is sustainable management. And for example, you may have regulations to exempt a very minor effect, but my submission was that aerially poisoning the water, the land, the forest is the most significant type of harmful effect you can possibly have. How can that type of serious effect be the effect that can be exempted and overlooked? It's the opposite of what those regulations require for sustainable management, which includes engaging with communities and looking at the values of local communities. It completely removed any ability to provide any protection for special communities, for cultural purposes, for amenity values, for any spiritual other purposes at all, or even to protect their water supplies. We also had a second argument that I found another section in the law which said no person may deposit any substance in the bed of any river without a resource consent. And in my submission, a poison bait is a substance. They were intentionally aerially spreading over the entire poison area into the beds of rivers, and whether it's dropped by helicopter, by truck, or by hand, it's still a deposit. I thought it was a very straightforward argument. Unfortunately, the High Court of New Zealand decided that where the law said no person shall deposit a substance, it somehow meant a substance that is not a hazardous substance. So in other words, the way our High Court interpreted that law was that you could deposit a hazardous substance on the bed of a river without any restriction whatsoever, but you did need a consent to deposit a safe substance on the bed of a river, which in my view does not achieve sustainable management and could never have been the purpose.
Just running back to that point, so the definition there is one of substance. And what you're trying to give it is a normal meaning of the word substance. And what you're suggesting is that the meaning that was then given by the court eventually was an abnormal meaning of the word substance. Can you just run over again what the definition they gave for substance?
In the High Court, the definition they gave was that substance means a substance that is not a hazardous substance.
Yep. Thank you very much.
We then went to the Court of Appeal and they said, well, if you comply with some of the other sections in the Resource Management Act, you can ignore this section.
Thank you very much.
We then went to the Supreme Court of New Zealand, which is the highest court in New Zealand, and they said, where the Act says substance, we think it really means object or structure.
And objects and structure, just for those in the audience, is an unusual description for substance.
In my submission, it was particularly unusual because Section 13(1)(a) specifically dealt with structures, whereas Section 1D, 13(1)(d) specifically dealt with substances.
Very good.
So we've had a lot of trouble with the courts applying the law and preferring to go with the policy of what they think the government wants enforced rather than what the law says. And I listened with interest to your definition of ecocide because, in my opinion, it fits very squarely within your definition of ecocide.
Could I just ask, following Justice Cleverly's question, are you saying that the higher courts took the view that the law is not to be applied literally, but what they think the politicians meant when they wrote the law?
Yes, and indeed in the High Court, the Minister for the Environment's evidence was nothing really about the law, but just think, Judge, about the implications if we can't continue to spread aerial poison over 2 million hectares of New Zealand.
So you are a lawyer, and so we're very fortunate that you are in this particular instance. So your suggestion is that the judges themselves took a view that was a political view.
Yes, that's my interpretation of what happened. The definition of substance, it's not specifically defined in the Resource Management Act, but we have a Hazardous Substances and New Organisms Act, we have Psychotic Substances Act, we have all sorts of...
Substance is a commonly defined word in law.
It's a very commonly defined word, and it's a word that has got a very broad meaning that is intended to capture a wide range of different materials and mixtures for the purpose of protecting the environment.
And what would be a common common definition of the word structure?
Definition of word structure?
Yeah.
The definition of a structure, as I understand it, is some kind of building or
something that's put together.
Thing that's put together, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
So we only had that decision recently from our Supreme Court, and it makes it extremely difficult for myself to advise my clients to go to court if we don't believe that the law is going to be enforced in the way that the law was intended when it was written. And what has happened in New Zealand now is that people have lost confidence in the justice system and going to our courts because of this type of decision. They've lost confidence in our politicians because they are not engaging on this issue and they are getting advice from very controlled scientific sources that is not looking at the wider issues and the interactions between of the environment. They're looking at, they're asking very specific questions to give themselves the answer that they want. For example, one of the native species, the native birds that is particularly affected by 1080 poison are the kea. They're our native parrots that live in our mountains and high country. The kea live typically, if they're not poisoned, to be 60, 80 or more years old. The native kea are being decimated by 1080 poison. By the government's own data, between 12 and 17% of kea in any environment that's poisoned are killed by the poison baits each drop. You cannot kill 12 to 17% of a species that lives to be 60 to 80 or more years old and expect that the survival of that species is in any way enhanced and clearly it's decimated. This reconciles with my experience spending a lot of time in our mountains that, you know, 10 or 20 years ago there were kea everywhere. Now you rarely see them.
And the same you hear throughout New Zealand about the silent forest and the lack of native birds in the areas that are poisoned. Now, where I get to with the science, somehow, for example, in the Nelson Lakes, Rotuiti, there was a monitoring of kea. There were two keas monitored, one died. That kea had been tracked over the years as one of the most successful breeding kea that they'd ever tracked. And yet the death of one female, highly prolific breeding kea was reported as a success in the government scientific reports because they said the chicks in that nest that season had, one of them had hatched. Now, so you can always find some positive in any situation to report, but if you're looking for sustainable management, you have to have integrity in the science and in what you report. If you've killed one of two adults that you're monitoring of a rare endangered species, it's very difficult, I believe, to justify calling it a success.
So you would suggest that would be some sort of manipulation of the data?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And it's typical with the other keas as well. They always report on some spurious criteria rather than how are the keas doing? How many kea have we got? They don't report on that. And it continues. Just in the last few weeks, they had another drop in Whatuaroa on the southwest coast of New Zealand where they monitored 11 kea, two died, and it's suspected that four died. There's a lot of confusion because they only monitor them for a few days, and if they lose the tracking, then they say, oh, well, they didn't die within the specified period of time, so let's ignore those ones that died. So their best data was 2 out of 11, and the worst, we suspect, was 4 out of 11 died. This was some new testing that they were doing to try and prove that the kea were now safe because they had a new safe way of doing it. You know, it goes on and on. Every time we get data, it takes us a lot of time to get data out of the government. I spend almost every day asking for different information about this issue from the government, as we're entitled to do under the Official Information Act in New Zealand. They stall, they delay, they have every excuse not to answer our questions because they know that without the data, we can't prove what we need to prove.
And some of that questioning has been done in writing?
All of the questions are done in writing. I've got, but mostly by email, electronically.
Okay.
I can provide hundreds of requests and hundreds of fob-offs and hundreds of delays if it's helpful.
Much appreciated.
Right. Are they not bound to respond within 30 days under that law?
The legal requirement is that they must respond as soon as reasonably practicable and no longer than 20 working days. What they do is they take the 20 working days as the starting point and add on from there. And we can go to the Ombudsman and complain, but the Ombudsman is so overworked that it might take 1 or 2 years to get a complaint through the Ombudsman, which makes the whole situation completely redundant. Plus, there's no sanction for any non-compliance with the Official Information Act. So it's a...
Sorry, if you could just repeat that. There is no sanction for...
There's no sanction for any breach of the Official Information Act. So if a government department refuses to give information, the worst thing that can happen is in 1 or 2 years later, the Ombudsman might say that they breached their obligations under the Act.
And what would be the punishment for that?
Nothing.
Okay.
There's no sanction for that. So it makes the whole situation incredibly difficult to get reliable information. And they also have other tactics of charging for information, although they haven't tried that with me recently, but coming up with, or they have, some of the councils have, coming up with massive, massive charges, thousands of dollars for information. And the starting point in New Zealand with the Official Information Act is the information belongs to the public of New Zealand, and the government are simply guardians of that information. But they forget that, and they don't recognise that if we're asking for information, it's because we want that information, it's our information that we want to see. And they do have a choice of publishing the information on their websites, in which case we won't need to ask them for it because we can easily access it. But they choose not to publish it on the websites because they don't really want us to have it. And then they complain that it's too onerous for them to provide it for us. We used to be able to just go to the government and turn up in their office and say, please, can we have a copy of this plan you've got to to do whatever you want to do, and you'd be able to meet a real person, and that real person would talk to you and answer your questions, and they would give you the information. But over the last few years, it's changed, and a lot of the government departments, now the doors are locked, there's no person you can speak to, and if you do actually make contact with a person, they say, well, this is an Official Information Act request, and we're going to put it through this long, complicated process, and we'll get back to you in due course.
And do you feel in some way that this is not just annoying, but is actually a concerted effort to prevent this, or is it just annoying?
It's much more than annoying because it's preventing us.
Do you think it's intentional or negligent or reckless?
I believe it's intentional, because the reason I believe that is if they have information that they want to give you, they can give it to you very quickly. And sometimes they do when it suits them to do so. But if they have information that they don't want to give, they're very, very slow in answering even very simple questions. I ask them, for example, that they have their own information and science on their website where they say that it takes 8 baits or more to kill somebody, and some of their claims are 20 baits. By my calculations, using the Ministry of Health's own data about toxicity of 1080 poison, I calculated that 1 bait would kill a young child, a small child, and say 2.5 to 3 baits would kill an adult, and just a small part of a bait would kill a baby. So I wrote to the government to ask the basis of the information that they used to calculate their numbers, and to ask why they thought I was wrong, what information they had to show why I was wrong in my calculations. Well, they've refused to answer that question.
Right. Now, with this seeming program going on here, now you've experienced obfuscation and blockages from local councils, from all levels of the court, from members of parliament, and the ministries and docs. So basically, it's almost as though there's a concerted effort at every level of government to poison the land there.
For some reason, our previous Prime Minister, John Key, adopted what he called the Predator 2050 strategy, which meant that there was a determination by the government to try and kill all predators, which is crazy, or perhaps all mammalian predators in New Zealand by 2050, and they were particularly targeting possums, rodents, and stoats. For some reason, that strategy has been given preeminence over every other fundamental right, the right to clean water, the right to safe wild food, the right to access our areas of New Zealand forests and countryside freely. All of those rights are being treated as unimportant compared to this idea from the former Prime Minister that we had to have a predator-free strategy. Now, the people of New Zealand have never been asked about the predator-free strategy. We've never had any, there was never any consultation on it before they adopted it. They simply appeared out of nowhere one day, and that has driven all of our government policy on poisoning ever since. And it's become this sort of mantra in the government that you can't even question it. And not it's bad enough that it's in the government, but it's in the media as well. The media don't want to ask questions about 1080 poison. If I say, look, why are we poisoning our water to try and save some birds? And we all want to save birds. The question is whether the poison will actually help the birds or not. And I think there's a lot of evidence that the poison doesn't help the birds, and it certainly kills a lot of the species of bird. But even if it did help the birds, does that justify poisoning the water supply for New Zealand's biggest city? And that's the sort of question that we have no forum in New Zealand to go to, because each court says, well, you know, our job is just to look at this little aspect, and our job is to look at this other little aspect. There's nowhere holistically where you can put all the information together and have this conversation. Now, it was supposed to be done with consultation. And when the 1080 poison was approved in New Zealand in 2008, it was reviewed and they decided, yes, its use could be continued, but that was subject to conditions. And one of those conditions was it was subject to consultation with the affected stakeholders and communities.
And the then CEO of the Ministry of Environment wrote a big paper on this. They published a big booklet about consultation and how fundamental it was that communities bought into the way they were treated. And yet somehow along the way, that has all been forgotten, even though it was a condition of the approval. And now we're told that the views of the public mean nothing. And even if I live on the edge of a forest and I take my water from that forest, I have even no guarantee of being consulted with. I don't even know when they're going to do it, because anyone that expresses concern about 1080 poison is designated by our government now as a terrorist.
Sorry, what do you mean by that?
Well, they now have decided that we are dangerous people. Every couple of days in the media is a story that...
So not actually as a terrorist, though?
Well, effectively as a terrorist.
So you're a lawyer, please define that.
Well, I can't define it because I don't ever see myself as a terrorist trying to protect the environment and the safe...
No, but you know what I mean. So if we could just...
A terrorist is a very serious allegation against people. Hmm. It's an allegation of doing some wrong to the community in a violent way. My experience of working with people all around New Zealand, in communities all around New Zealand, is that the opposite applies. Most of the people who don't want poison in our water and in our food and dropped on our or near our communities are very peaceful people who are extremely concerned about the environment.
Are you saying that the police and the regulatory authorities are saying that their job is to do what the government wants?
Yes, and they've said it to me. After the poison drop, a group of us asked for a meeting with the police. They didn't respond to our request, so we went to the police station and waited until a policeman was available to meet with us. They eventually gave us a senior police officer who came and spoke with us, and I specifically put to him that, do you not understand your duty is to enforce the law and protect the public interest? He said, no, our duty is to look after the authorities.
Well, what you've said is not unique, because from my understanding, two people in the last century said exactly the same thing. One was called Adolf Hitler, the other one was called Stalin. And what they did was, after being put into office, and Hitler was put in by a democratic vote, they then switched things around to say that the regulatory authorities are to do what we want you to do, irrespective of the law.
And that's exactly what is unfortunately happening in New Zealand. We have many cases of scientists who have been fired for giving advice that the government didn't like. The other video we showed on a couple of days ago showed Mike Meads, the entomologist, who had done a report that was unpopular, but he's just one of many. They either get fired or their funding gets diverted to another cause, or they their projects are sidestepped.
Question. Is there any evidence of a human being affected by the poison? This is one.
Yes.
If there was...
Yes.
Was he advised to appeal to the court? Second, I mean, what do you expect for the International Tribunal to do when, in what way we can be of help? Nobody heard about this business of the poison. There must have been an intention why the government allowed this.
Yes.
I don't think they intended to kill people, but different species have been affected. Would you kindly...
Well, they are killing people with 1080 poison in New Zealand, but none of those cases get on the public records. So one example was an American tourist called Whitney Roby, who was tramping near Queenstown in New Zealand, and she started to feel very ill. She'd been tramping through an area where there'd been 1080 poison gel, not aerially spread in that case, but the same poison put in the forest. And she checked into a backpackers in Queenstown, and she died that night. A doctor was called to ascertain the cause of death, and his suspected cause of death was 1080 poison. They took her heart and they posted it or couriered it to the laboratory to test to confirm the cause of death. And it was lost on the way.
Where was the laboratory?
I believe it was in Auckland, but I'm not sure.
Okay, so in New Zealand. Okay.
In New Zealand. The heart was lost on the way, so there was never confirmation. So that was never counted on the official records as a death from 1080 poison. It was always counted as an unknown cause. There was another case a few years ago where I acted for a family in Pitaru who'd eaten wild boar, and the three members of that family all became very ill with projectile vomiting, then convulsions, and then into a coma within a few hours of eating the same meal. And they were the only ones that ate that food, and their younger daughters, very luckily, didn't eat the wild pork, which is why we knew it was the wild pork. They were admitted to hospital for the for 4 to 6 weeks before they came out of the coma, and they suffered quite serious side effects for a long time after that. They didn't know if they were going to survive. But the very first documentation in the hospital was suspected 1080 poisoning. Then overnight, that documentation, somehow the diagnosis changed to botulism, and I mentioned that case before. So that's another case where the objective scientific evidence and medical evidence is that it was clearly likely to have been 1080 poisoning, especially when you look at the test results, and it could never have been botulism, and that's been completely ruled out now. There is no other suspected cause. The most likely cause is 1080 poison, but it never gets on the register. We used to have a register in New Zealand by what's called the ESR, the Environmental and Scientific Research Institute, who were responsible for maintaining records of poisoning, I think from 2000 until 2008 or around those years. But then their funding was cut, and as far as I can ascertain, nobody is keeping any data of environmental poisoning cases. So there are no official records. When we became aware of that for the Brook Valley case, because we thought the same, well, if it's so bad, where are all the cases of poison? We started talking around the community because there are a lot of stories of people that had been affected by 1080 poison, but there were no official records. And we traced all of those people back, and we put together a group of four of us, all scientists, put together a register of unintended poisoning of humans and also of dogs and other animals. And everyone had to either prepare an affidavit and or medical documentation to prove the cause of their death or their harm, yes, which they did. And that's got over 30 cases of humans suffering from poisoning, but not one of those cases are on the official government records.
I've got a very simple question. I have a glass of water in front of me. If you put some 1080 into that water and I drank it, what, in your expert opinion, would be the likely outcome?
If you put a pellet of 1080 in the water, you'd be very sick.
And if you put two pellets in?
If you put two pellets in, you've got a 50% chance of dying.
I see. So, yeah.
Mm. The other problem with the pellets is that they spread them by helicopter, but the government records from the Ministry for the Environment show that at least one third of poison drops, the pellets go outside the approved area. And it's particularly in the case of children, when only one pellet could cause a child to die, the thought that one pellet might land in a school or in a family home, the backyard, I just find it impossible to understand how anybody that's in a position of power could think that's acceptable. We right. have had those cases. I didn't answer the second half of your question about what I would personally love to happen would be for this commission to come to New Zealand and undertake an investigation in New Zealand to raise awareness for New Zealanders, because we have trouble in New Zealand even making other New Zealanders aware of this, apart from word of mouth and social media, to raise awareness and to ask our government why they're doing this. I think that'd be a huge advantage, because New Zealand is actually a small country, and it would ascertain whether they were doing it intentionally or
whether there was just some big mistake and they hadn't understood the implications of what they're doing, but it's a wonderful test case for the ITNJ to hold a government to account. And because I would love New Zealand to be a model for the world of how things can be done when people are aware and the spotlight is shown of what the problems are.
Yeah, Dr. Gray, thanks very much for that kind invitation. We will definitely consider that, and we consider the other evidence as well. One of the other things, apart from seeing the intention of the government, there's obviously a commercial element to this as well, and we haven't really looked at that. Is there any commercial benefit to anyone? Is there any commercial benefit to anyone who may be associated to the government?
There's a lot of commercial benefit to the companies that make the poison and to the helicopter companies that are the ones that are prepared to fly and spread the poison. Many of the helicopter companies in New Zealand refuse to spread the poison, but there are a number that make a lot of money out of this. One of the things of real concern, actually, is that they use our rescue helicopters. In New Zealand, it's often a long way to the hospitals, and at least on several occasions, they use our rescue emergency helicopters that normally take people to hospital for spreading the poison. And it's a real concern because the government has this mentality somehow that this poison is safe. And the Minister of Conservation has been on the national TV saying 1080 poison is safe. And so it takes away from the seriousness of what's happening when the government is saying it's safe, despite the warning label that's saying it's not safe, and somehow justifying using rescue helicopters for spreading poison, and they might be taking someone with a heart attack or a broken leg or a baby that's being prematurely born to hospital, all sorts of different
scenarios. And Dr. Gray, just go back to the second part of that question. Is there, to your knowledge, and if there isn't, that's perfectly fine. We're just beginning these depositions and taking this evidence at this point. Is there any connection at all between commercial interests and the government in a mutual benefit there, or not at this stage, to your knowledge?
Well, yes, the government owns the factory that makes the 1080 poison baits.
Okay.
It's just called a state-owned enterprise, Animal Control Products in Whanganui, and there's a second factory in New Zealand that makes 1080 poison baits, which is 49% owned by the West Coast Regional Council, which is the council on the west coast of the South Island, which spreads a large amount of these poison baits.
So that's quite an unusual commercial connection.
There's a very large commercial connection, and very interestingly, the West Coast Regional Council factory pest control research just had a major incident about 2 or 3 weeks ago, where one of their workers was admitted to hospital in a coma. He's been in a coma for 2 weeks, as far as I've heard since I've been here. He's still in a hospital in a coma, suspected from 1080 poison.
So not a botched case of botulism.
Well, people are joking on social media. Right. Is it going to be botulism or is it going to be 1080 poison?
Yeah, I can see that.
So, you know, we... Right. Yeah.
If I just... I think we're moving... one more question over there, then perhaps...
Yeah. I just wanted to finish up. Well, I had two questions, and that was one of them. Just to make clear, state-owned enterprise, the shareholders are ministers of the government, are they not?
Yes, the shareholders are the Minister of Finance and the Minister of Agriculture.
Right.
They hold 50% of the shares each.
No, thank you. That was covered. And my other one was, and I really wanted to cover this because it wasn't fully. You put a lot in. The ongoing effects on the biosphere. You're talking about some of the potential fungal things. Just briefly, because we do have to move on here, but I would love to get that bit in here.
There are two main problems. One is that the ultimate breakdown product of 1080 poison is methyl fluoride, which is also known as Freon, which is really serious for the environment, for the atmosphere, because it's one of the worst gases for greenhouse gases. The other serious problem we've identified is that the cereal bait that's used in 1080 poison, we can't find out where they get it from or even what cereal is used. They say it's a commercial secret. But many cereal baits contain phytophthora, and other fungal spores, and also aflatoxin, so fungal byproducts that are toxic to humans and to animals. We've just had a major problem in New Zealand with our kauri trees dying from what's called kauri dieback, which is a strain of phytophthora. and the suspicion is that that Phytophthora could be aerially spread in the dust of the poison baits, which is spreading it over roughly 10% of New Zealand's land area this year. At the very least, one would think that a responsible government would stop any poison drops until that can be properly investigated. The aspergillosis, that is a fungal disease caused by aflatoxins. We've just had 7 of our very, very rare kakapo die of aspergillosis. We don't know the source of the aspergillosis, but again, is it coming from the cereal bait and or a combination of the poison? Because if you're suppressing the immune system with poison and perhaps a bit of Roundup thrown into the cereal, plus the dust from the cereal with the spores and everything else, it's just a lethal concoction. So there are so many, again, there's so many areas of this that have never been explored. That issue was not looked at by IRMA when they did their review in 2008. They didn't think of that. It's just something that I've put together with a couple of scientists who have been really concerned, and we've developed this theory and become more and more concerned as the evidence tends to reconfirm our concerns.
Thank you again, Dr. Graham.